The conference is called France and Britain in World War II. In fact, of course, the time frame has overlapped or débordé far to both forward and back from that. So we've had 1919, and we've had Versailles, and we've had the conflictual interwar legacy of World War I, and, for example, the British reluctance to give any peacetime commitments to France. We've had Churchill and pre-war France in the 1930s. We've had intelligence cooperation on the eve and at the very start of the war. And then post-liberation, we've talked about the longer liberation period and Anglo-French relations in that up to 47 or so. We've made allusions to Suez. We've had an allusion to France's withdrawal from NATO and to Britain's attempt to get into the EEC in the context of the failure to translate M.R.D. Foote's SOE book. So that actually covers half a century. And I got a slight sense that it keeps happening that there are sort of missed opportunities over this half century. There are moments when it looks just possible that a special Franco-British relationship might happen, but it doesn't quite. And that it did not happen, one might explain in terms of three broad categories: interrelated, confusingly so. And those are, one, real conflicts of interest, though of course there are also sometimes convergences. Two, perceptions through which real conflicts of interest are refracted and perhaps non-existent ones imagined or past ones resuscitated. And three, the personalities who articulate the real conflicts of interest and the perceptions of them. Now, of course, if it's half a century, we still pivoted a lot on the war years, which fall roughly in the middle of our half century. The war years are hardly a typical period. On the contrary, relations between our two countries are fraught with exceptional difficulties. Britain is fighting with great ruthlessness a war of national survival, and never is that ruthlessness better demonstrated than at Mers el Kabir. France is divided between Vichy and the Free French Movement and the internal resistance. This is not a typical France to deal with. And, crucially, the relationship is more asymmetrical than at any time, at least in modern times, before or since. Forms of cooperation between our two countries are unusual. We don't usually involve ourselves in weapons drops or tuition to resistance agents in how to do an intelligence report. So it's a very untypical period, but I think there's a strong case for saying that it's a pivot period. Take, for example, real conflicts of interest. We've heard, for example, about colonies and navies, and perhaps these lose some of their importance in the immediate post-war years. On the other hand, the United Kingdom comes out of the post-war years very clear that having a good relationship with the United States has an existential importance for the UK. And France comes out of the war years convinced that settling the relationship with Germany one way or another is of absolutely existential importance for France. Then there's the category of perceptions, the British view of the defeat of 1940, the notion that France simply folded up, lasts longer than the war years themselves. It's also perhaps in the war years that a British perception that it's really impossible to deal with the French, whether you're dealing with de Gaulle on the one hand, or whether you're dealing with the politicians of the Third Republic or the politicians of the Fourth Republic on the other. They're just too difficult to cope with, and that this gives rise to perhaps a type of condescension towards the French in many quarters of British government, including some parts of the Foreign Office, against which Oliver Harvey tries to fight. French perceptions, on the other hand, and here I focus very much on Gaullism, a focus perhaps on the best sort of six-word definition of Gaullism that I ever heard. It was from Pierre Mesmer, and it's simply autorité de l'État et indépendance nationale. And I don't think you can begin to understand the post-war Gaullist insistence on indépendance nationale unless you have a good idea of what dépendance nationale looks like, for example, in de Gaulle's years in London. And then there are the personalities who articulate the conflicts of interest and the perceptions and they do so perhaps not invariably in a helpful way. The towering personalities of Churchill and de Gaulle, indispensable to the fate of each country, also arguably get in the way of one window of opportunity in the liberation period and cast a long shadow. So, yes, we're right to view World War II as pivotal to the relationship between our two countries. And the task of disentangling the relationship between objective interests, whether conflictual or converging, from perceptions and from the personalities who shape them, is an ongoing task, not only for historians, but also for practitioners. Before I close, please allow me to ride my hobby horse for 2 minutes. Between 1940 and 1945, British and American aircraft dropped well over 500,000 tons of bombs on France and killed between 57,000 and 60,000 French civilians. That's a death toll of the same order as the number killed by German action, the Blitz and V1s and V2s, in the same period in the UK. Perhaps two-thirds of this record is due to RAF Bomber Command. I think these facts are relevant to the study of Franco-British relations in the war years, although I concede they are not easy to fit in, which is why perhaps the bombing is often left out of the narrative or marginalized. How should we deal with it? Should we simply say, yes, the collateral damage was horrendous, but this was war, and everyone understood that the raids were necessary? Or should we suggest that this record counts for perhaps a bit more than that? That it was, for example, the ultimate expression of a deeply, if temporarily, asymmetrical relationship between our two countries that continues to shape, in sometimes perverse ways, differing memories of the war on the two sides of the Channel? Thank you very much.